that, I'm going to start off on our recording. This week's Torah portion is Parshat Vayetze. Vayetze, the story of, so last week in our Torah, I love to portray, especially the book of Genesis, as a giant soap opera, because it really is. It's just an interfamilial train wreck soap opera, right? So last week in our Torah, we had the story of Jacob cheating his brother Esau out of, or Yaakov and Esav, cheating his brother out of both the blessing and the birthright. The last moment in the Parsha, Rivka, their mother turns to Jacob and says, "Your brother's going to kill you, run." And Yaakov runs. So Yaakov runs, and as he's running, we get the opening scene in Vayetze, the Hebrew word Vayetze meaning, "and he went out," meaning he ran. And one of the first things that happens in the first 10 verses is this little story. And the story is of Yaakov lying down on the ground and having a dream. And the dream is that God comes to him with angels coming and going on ladders. And then Yaakov has a reaction. I could talk about what else happens in the Parsha from a story perspective, but from a Hasidus perspective, we're not interested. We're going to look at four texts that basically don't get any further than the first couple lines. And that's because the Hasidim, the rabbis of the 18th and 19th century, are just fascinated by this visual image of angels going up and down. And they're fascinated by the idea of God appearing in person to Yaakov and what it means, what the verses specifically mean. Because I think for the Hasidim, the idea of divine meeting, of having an in-person conversation with Hashem Yisborach, and how we do that is really important, right? They really want to know what it is that triggers this kind of reaction and what this kind of reaction teaches us about our tradition. All right, so we're going to take a look. I'll read this opening stuff in the Hebrew. I'm only going to read the first line in the Hebrew because we're going to look at it in a couple of our Hasidic comments. Hopefully we'll have time to get all the way to the fourth text because I really like the story of the rabbi in the fourth text. The fourth text is really cool too, but you know, if we don't get to it or if we have to do it in the past 1:30 time, that's what happens. All right. Vayachalom vahine sulam mutzav artsa varosho magia hashamayma vahine malache Elohim olim v'yordimbo. He, we're talking about Yaakov, had a dream. A stairway was set on the ground, and its top reached to the sky. And angels of God were going up and down on it. Okay. And then the second verse, which a little bit of it will be useful for us. And the Lord was standing beside him, and God said, "I am the Lord, the God of your father Abraham and the God of Isaac. The ground on which you are lying, I will assign to you and to your offspring." All right. So our first comment is going to be from the Holy Besht, the Baal Shem Tov himself, the progenitor, the creator, the originator, the OG of Chassidut, right? And he was a guy who was deeply interested in the mystical tradition and one of the earlier individuals to make serious and significant comment about what is called gematria. Okay. I think most of you know gematria, but in the event that you are not familiar with it or need a quick refresher, I will describe it. Gematria is Jewish numerology, right? The practice of taking the Hebrew letters, assigning number values, adding up the number values of one word, and attributing it to another word. We do this a lot in Judaism. In fact, the reason that your tzitzit on your tallit have the number of fringes that they do is because the numbers in the word tzitzit and the numbers in the word Adonai Echad equal out to the numbers of fringes on the corners of your garments, right? We play Hebrew numerology just to make basic ritual items in Judaism. So here we're going to have an interesting one, and I actually did the math for us. I was once told as a joke by another rabbi that there would be no math in rabbinical school, but alas, that is not true. You have to at least be able to add in order to be a decent rabbi. So the Baal Shem Tov tells us this, and the verse is, Vayechalom v'hine sulam mutzav artsa. So, and he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder which extended downward to the earth. And the word sulam is going to be of interest to the Baal Shem Tov. So the Baal Shem Tov says the following. The Baal Shem Tov said, the word ladder in Gematria is equal to the word wealth. Okay, the word for wealth in Hebrew is mamon. So I put in the notes down here, I will highlight it and you will see it. So the Hebrew letters of sulam are samech, vav, lamed, mem. Samech is 60, vav is 6, lamed is 30, mem is 40. That totals out to 136. If you scroll down here, you see in the other note that the word mamon is mem, 40, mem, 40, vav, 6, nun, 50. And that adds up to 136. Behold, the math works. By the way, you don't really need the math to work, which is kind of an amazing thing, because in Hebrew, you can play with the vavs and you can play with the yuds. If you need to borrow or subtract 6 anywhere, you can throw a vav into a word that has an O or an U in it. And if you need to add 10 or subtract 10 from a word, you can always yank the yud out or put a yud in anytime there's an E, an A, or an E sound. So there's a lot of cheating you can do here, and usually the Hasidim do. This one happens to be pure. They didn't mess with anything. All the letters show up exactly as they're supposed to. So the word ladder in Gematria is equal to the word wealth. Thus is the nature of material wealth according to the example of a ladder. One goes up or down because of it. It can be that wealth brings a person down to the lowest depths of Sheol, and it can be that it raises a person to the highest of heights. It all depends on how one uses their wealth. So this is our conversation that we opened the class with, the notion of what is the value of wealth? What ought a billionaire to do with their money, right? Leaving aside taxation and the forced reallocation of wealth by our government to other people, whether it is moral or not. Jewishly, we do believe in tzedakah. It's an extremely important mitzvah, and there are right ways and wrong ways to give tzedakah. But the Baal Shem Tov is going in a different direction, which is to say that, and our Hasidim generally do a thing with this, which is to say that your wealth is an extension of you. And if you use it for good things, it demonstrates good values, and it demonstrates care and love for others. And if you use it for bad things, here the Baal Shem Tov brings it to a really kind of powerful conclusion. It can raise you up or lower you down. And I think he's implying this morally, spiritually, and ethically, right? And he kind of highlights it by saying, you can go down, quote, to the depths of Sheol. Now, Sheol is the name of a dark, nethery underworld place, which is where we are told in the Torah the dead go. But when the Baal Shem Tov uses it, he's clearly kind of talking about it as a hell-like place. Like, this is a bad place. And so the idea of a person wasting their money on bad things and then going to a bad place is the idea that we are being presented with here. So it's a lovely kind of image. All right, that's our first text. From there, we're going to pivot to some different topics and some different issues. And they're very lovely kind of moral and spiritual in nature. So we're actually, even though we spent a lot of time as a group before I turned on the recording talking about the notion of wealth and what is good and what is right, clearly, regardless of where we ended up individually on our discussion, wealth can be used to raise up, as I think we were alluding to when we talked about Bill Gates spending money on raising money at first for malaria abatement and then raising money for the COVID vaccine. For those of you who haven't read up on it, it's really a fascinating story. There's been a number of interviews with Bill Gates. He spent a lot of time trying to figure out what should his philanthropy be. And he had clearly, literally, billions of dollars to spend. And ultimately, the interview I saw with him, he ultimately concluded that he wanted to literally do the most good for the most people. And some philanthropists came to him and said, people in poor countries need access to clean water and they need mosquito nets. And your bang for your buck will be maximized. You will save the most human lives and improve the quality of life for the largest quantity of people on Earth if you spend, you know, a couple bucks on mosquito nets and wells in Southeast Asia and Sub-Saharan Africa. And Gates goes, well, then that's what we're doing, which I think was a really interesting perspective on utilitarianist philanthropy, doing the most good for the most people. All right. So that's our kind of topic on how wealth can raise up and bring down from the Baal Shem Tov. Our next text is from another favorite of this class. He is often referred to by me as the Alter Rebbe. He is referred to as the Alter Rebbe in the Chabad community because he is the first Rebbe of Lubavitch. His name was Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi, who lived from 1745 to 1813. That would put him as a disciple either directly of the Dove Bear of Meserich or the generation that came after the Dove Bear, which makes him essentially second or third generation Hasidim. So really old school. So he said regarding the verse, behold, angels of God were going up and coming down on it. He said this, the Torah Or, Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Liadi, wrote, quote, angels of God ascending. The angels ascend to heaven on the strength of Torah and commandments. Descending, the angels descend to this world on the merit of Jacob and bring with them Shefa, or divine light, and blessing. So I want to stop and think about this one. This is like one of those bumper sticker texts I like to talk about. It needs a little bit more unpacking than your standard bumper sticker text. So the question that our rabbis are asking is, why are we getting these extra words of a ladder and angels going up and a ladder and angels going down, right? Why use both the phrases up and down? And also, what are the metaphysics of this experience, right? What are the angels doing going up and what are the angels doing going down? Like, it's a real basic question. What does this dream mean? Why is there a ladder? Why are there angels? Why do some angels go up? Why do some angels go down? When you look at rabbinic thought, there are a variety of expressions of what they think angels are. They are not the fat Renaissance babies with wings and, like, you know, little bows and arrows, like I think a lot of people think. They are not the Hallmark Channel, right? It's not Michael, all of you know this reference, right? It is not Michael Landon from that TV show, a really handsome guy who shows up and fixes stuff and appears and disappears at occasional moments. An angel generally in Jewish thought going into basically the modern period is kind of a single action divine mechanism. So, like, for instance, the thing that the sunlight that comes and makes your tomatoes grow, on some level, that is a divine emanation. That is an angel. The angel comes down, radiates, the photosynthesis takes place, and the angel goes, I made the tomato grow, I'm done. And the angel goes, poof, and that's that, right? That is one fairly often regarded mechanism of what an angel is. So when we're talking about angels going up and down, we're kind of dealing with that metaphysic, right? Of a divine object that conveys and is, by the way, I don't think the angels feel bad when they go poof, right? An angel has a responsibility. It is a shaliach for Hashem. It is a messenger of the divine, meaning its responsibility is to do an action for God. And then once it has fulfilled its action, it no longer continues to exist. So that is a classic Jewish understanding of what an angel is. And that's why I say it ain't Michael Landon, because God forbid Michael Landon, you know, helps one person and then disappears. Now, that doesn't necessarily have to be the only metaphysic by which angels work. There are angels throughout the Torah and through the Tanakh, who are not single action angels, right? Michael is an angel that we regard as the angel of healing. Clearly, Michael doesn't go poof when one person is healed. Metatron is one who is regarded in the Talmud as some sort of very powerful angel. And I can't really explain it any further than that until otherwise I would get into either Kabbalah or heresy or possibly both. So that's a little bit about angels. So here we have this text which talks about angels. I'm going to share it again just so you can have a look at it. We have this metaphysic of the angels. And the metaphysic that's being described is the angels go up, and what brings them up? Torah and commandments, right? That the purpose of this sulam, of the ladder that exists between our world and God, is to bring, it's a conveyor belt. And it's a conveyor belt of the human, things that humans do up to God. And the things that humans do that goes up to God that we regard as valuable for in the world beyond is Torah and mitzvot. The interesting thing here in this verse that I find fascinating is the pronounal suffix, I suppose, that goes on here. Because in the Hebrew, it says that it's Torato u'mitzvotav, right? It is, to be blunt, his Torah and his mitzvot. And I think that that can work in two ways, right? One is to say that God's Torah and God's commandments are being conveyed from earth upward. But another way to say that is that God is the one who provides the Torah and the mitzvot, but we're the one who actualizes them. So we actually kind of do the action that makes them like relevant in the world. All right. And then the final thing and that is great about this, the important line that I'm kind of taking a long time getting to, Rabbi, get to the point, is what happens when the angels bring that Torah and mitzvot up? And the answer is that Hashem Yisborach shines Shefa, which some have described as divine light or divine radiance. One of my colleagues describes it as, I think it's Rabbi Marquis calls it divine radiation, right? It's this unseeable entity that's an energy that comes from above, and bracha and blessing. So the metaphysic here is the ladder is a conveyor belt. We send what we do as good up, and God sends what God responds down. But they're not necessarily attached to one another, which I think is also kind of neat, right? We give up Torah and mitzvot, and God sends down Shefa. But there's no implication that you're going to get Shefa in exchange for Torah, and there's no implication that God is going to shine down Shefa and expect anything from us. And I think that's also an important notion of the divine metaphysic here, which is understanding that we do good in the universe because we are created in order to create good in the universe. And Hashem sends down the divine goodness as radiation because that's what Hashem does. That's what God does. And the two are not necessarily attached. Now, what do I do with the ladder? I don't know, man. I think the ladder is a fun kind of notion. The other piece that's interesting here is we're taking a specific instance in Torah, the story of Jacob and the ladder, and we're extracting from it and extrapolating from it an entire metaphysics of how God works in the universe, which is to imply that Jacob is the beginning of this linkage between the upper world and the lower world, for good or for bad. We're actually going to see if we get to the fourth text how that kind of plays out a little bit more. But I think it's a neat idea to kind of play with this notion of like, how does God receive and connect from the upper to the lower worlds? Tanya has a comment here which I really liked. I didn't know Michael Landon was Jewish. Marilyn says Michael Landon is Jewish. I had no idea. Tanya says the Torah elevates the soul. I think that's a really lovely idea, that the sulam, that the ladder, is Torah itself, right? It raises up. So it's not just we send our Torah up into the world, but that the Torah takes us up many rungs. The Hasidim often speak of going up in madregas, in going up in levels, or going up in rungs through our action. And one of the tensions that we've talked about in this class many moons ago is the tension between the Hasidim who believe that all human beings are capable of the highest rung and are constantly, aspiring to go up, or whether certain benighted individuals are more worthy or less worthy, are of a higher madriga or of a lower madriga. Regardless, we're all kind of trying to get up there. Tanya's wondering about Stairway. We'll leave Led Zeppelin out of this conversation. There's other Zeppelin songs that I prefer more. That's the important thing here. Okay, great. We're going to, unless there's any comments on this notion. Rich, go ahead. If you have any questions also.
It's a question, really. So did I hear that there was something was equating the ladder to wealth? If I heard correctly, why would that connection be made?
Okay, so you're going back to the last text. And it's a great question. The connection is through gematria, right? And the gematria is if you take the letters samech lamed vav sulam mem sofit, it adds up to 136. And if you take the word mamon, which is the word for wealth, and you add up the letters mem vav and nun, you also get 136. And that's the trick that the rabbis like to play. If the addition works out, then you can do it. By the way, there's another cheat. I told you about cheats in gematria where you can play with the yuds and the vavs. There's another cheat in gematria which you see a lot, mostly in fanatical chat rooms for QAnon lunatics, and I do mean lunatics, which is there's a cheat that you can use in all gematria and numerology, which is if you have a 30 and the 30, adding the 30 to the equation doesn't help you, you could lop the zero off the 30 and make it a 3 and add the 3 to the equation. You'll occasionally see that in gematria, which is why you probably don't see me do a lot of gematria in this class. And the reason is I think that about 95% of gematria is hot garbage on a stick and I have nothing to do with it. But when it serves my purposes and when it allows for us to have a conversation about billionaires and millionaires, I will bring it in. When a gematria is really good, I'll suspend the rules, right? One of the cool things about being a rabbi, I get to suspend the rules when I want to. Okay. Any other questions? Dan's taking a phone call. Rana, tell Dan to turn off the thing. I'm just kidding. All right. Great. We're going to keep going. We'll do the third-ish and the fourth-ish text. So our third text for today is another one of my faves who we see somewhat frequently in this class, Yaakov Yosef of Polonia, who is also third generation, meaning he would have learned from the dove bear, so old, old school. And he's going to combine two verses. The first one that he combines is, and he laid down in that place, Vayishkav b'makom hazeh. I think it's b'makom hahu, I don't remember. And then another verse later, we get V'adonai Nitzav alav, and God was standing either with him, or some of our commentators have fun with this, upon him. Alav literally means God was standing on Jacob. Okay, so what's his comment? Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polonia, the author of the Baal HaToldot, said, when it was that he laid upon the earth, it's a really short comment, don't worry, when it was that he laid upon the earth, in shvalut, in lowliness or humility, Miyad, immediately, the Shekhinah rested upon him. This is a classic rabbinic drash, which is to say, like, what's the interesting thing that Rabbi Yaakov Yosef is taking from this? That it's when you lie down in the dirt that God appears to you. So this is almost related to that first text of ours, which is to say, millionaires and billionaires who are incapable of humility, people who need to be, you know, serve with a silver spoon or expect to kind of live in a world of luxury and fantasy and wonder, they never really truly get to experience the Shekhinah, the imminent presence of the divine. They are not worthy of knowing God in an intimate way. It is only in humility, degradation, lowliness, kind of getting down and dirty, I think is literally the metaphor here, that you can know Hashem Yisborach. I'll give an example of this that one of my colleagues taught me. So for those of us who watched the funeral proceedings of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, her rabbi, she had two rabbis at Addis Israel in Washington, D.C. One of them is Rabbi Lauren Holtzblatt, and one of them is Rabbi Aaron Alexander, who is Rabbi Holtzblatt's co-rabbi. And Aaron Alexander was has been a colleague of mine and a good friend of mine for a really long time. He was also a teacher to Jeremy Marquis. But Aaron and I went to school together. We're in the same class. And Aaron taught me a really valuable lesson as a rabbi, which was when he became the assistant dean of the Ziegler School, one of his responsibilities was to be the mashgiach. And a mashgiach is a guy who, for all of you who know about mashgichut, who is the religious person who goes into the kitchen and checks things out. And Aaron worked for a number of different Jewish institutions, and as the mashgiach, he took it upon himself, especially when he started at Addis, but also when he was back at the Ziegler School, to work in the kitchen. So that meant that if they were taking a delivery at 5:30 in the morning, he would show up and unload the boxes. And if they had, he would take a couple days where he'd work the line and slice tomatoes, or he'd make the soup. And that's not in his direct responsibilities as a mashgiach. In fact, I think a lot of modern mashgichim would argue that that interferes with his responsibility as a mashgiach. But Aaron would argue, you can't do the work, you can't build the respect with the line chefs unless you get down and dirty. You know, you do the work. You literally chop the onions and you unload the truck at 5:30 in the morning. And I that was really valuable to me because eventually, when I was in my sixth year as a rabbi, I became the rabbi of the day school in Denver. And one of my responsibilities was to be the mashgiach. And so at some point every year, I went in and I chopped onions and I unloaded the truck and I made sure to help them out because that's what a mashgiach should do. In order to know God in a true way, you have to be willing to get your fingernails dirty. All right, that's that text. We'll finish with the last text. I really like this text too, Audrey. I think it's really valuable. I think rabbis should be unclogging the copier. I think rabbis should be able to flip on a light switch. They should stack chairs. They should do all the things. Okay. In Erie, I can't do that because I can't set up for Kiddush and lead services and read Torah all at the same time. It's basically a one-man show in Erie. I do moderate the Zoom feed while also doing the rabbiing at the same time. You know, Seth has Ken, I have me. Okay, all right, let's do the last text with our final few minutes. This is that one that I was really excited about. Before I we read the text, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the author who wrote the text because I think we've seen his name once in this class. But first, we'll look at the verses that are the contributing material for the text. So, Vayikatz Yaakov mishenato, vayomer Aken, yesh Adonai b'makom hazeh v'anochi lo yadati. One of the best lines in all of the Torah. Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, Aken. Doesn't really have a good translation, but here it's translated as, surely the Lord is present in this place, and I did not know. So va'anochi is of a word, it's a name for I that is formal and very rarely used in Torah, and our commentators have fun with that, not this one, but if you're at shul this week and you want to hone in on a word, the anochi is a really important one. Second verse, shaken, he said, how awesome is this place? Ma nora hamakom hazeh. This is none other than the abode of God. Ein zeh ki im bait Elohim. Right? And that is the gateway to heaven. Vezeh shar hashamayim. This is a chock-a-block amazing sentence. There are a bazillion things you could do with it. We are not going to belabor it too much. But you can see why this Torah portion, when rabbis and commentators are riffing on it, they rarely get past the first 15 lines because there's so much good stuff in it. If I'm not mistaken, we're in the second triennial read, which means I'm almost certain we're not doing this one this year, which is a crime. It's a crime, I say. One of the things that's fun about being a rabbi, especially a rabbi who's been a rabbi who shows up every month at his synagogue as opposed to every week, is I never feel obligated to be stuck with the triennial read that is before us. I will talk about whatever I want to talk about. As you all saw last week when I gave the Dvar Torah at Beth Shalom, and I decided to talk about big synagogues and little synagogues, which does not appear in last week's Torah portion at all. If it's interesting and it's Torah, you can talk about it. All right, what's my point? So the interesting one from this one, he's really interested, our commentator is going to be really interested in the words, Ki im bait Elohim. This is none other than the abode or the house of God. And this notion of a bait Elohim, a house of God, and what does it mean and why is it here? So we'll look at this in a second. Our commentator is a guy by the name of Shimon Shalom of Amshinov. So the Amshinover Hasidim are a really interesting Hasidic sect. They are from a town just outside of Warsaw. And the early Amshinover Rebbeim were from this third generation of Hasidim, meaning they can trace their lineage, of course, just like most of them, all the way back to the Baal Shem Tov himself. Rabbi Shimon Shalom, who was the second son of the third Amshinover Rebbe, was living in Poland at the time of World War II. And somehow, I don't know how, I would love to read his biography if there is one, in the late 30s and early 40s, he saw it coming. And by that, I mean he saw the rise of Hitler as an existential threat to his Jewish community. And so starting in 1938, he encouraged the Amshinover Hasidim to leave Poland. And he started to raise funds for them to take a one-way ticket to Shanghai, right? Imagine having that kind of wisdom and forethought. By the way, I know two Jews who are Jews who were evacuated as really little children and went to Shanghai. So Rabbi Shimshon Shalom and the Amshinover Hasidim eventually sent 24,000 of their Hasidim to Shanghai. And Shanghai, of course, was part of China, but it was under Japanese occupation. And during the Nazi Axis powers rise, the Japanese were encouraged by the Germans to turn over their populations to the Jewish populations to the Germans. And there is a great story that I found online about Shimshon Shalom of Amshinov, who himself wound up in Shanghai shortly before the German invasion of Poland. And the story goes like this. As World War II intensified, the Nazis stepped up pressure on Japan to hand over the Shanghai Jews. In a book, the episode was described as that the Japanese military governor of the city sent for the Jewish community leaders. The delegation included our friend Rabbi Shimshon Shalom Kalish of Amshinov. The Japanese governor was curious. Why do the Germans hate you so much? They said. Without hesitation and knowing the fate of his community hung on his answer, Reb Kalish told the translator in Yiddish, Zugem vel mir seinen Orientalim. Tell him the Germans hate us because we are Oriental. The governor, whose face had been stern throughout the confrontation, broke into a slight smile. In spite of the military alliance, he did not accede to the German demand, and the Shanghai Jews were never handed over. So that is just an absolutely classic Jewish story, which is you disarm someone by saying something funny in Yiddish, right? Kalish eventually, at the end of the war, brought his entire Jewish community, not the entire group, a small number stayed behind, but the Amshinover Hasidim were relocated to Borough Park, Brooklyn. And the kicker to this story is kind of, the only kicker I have, is kind of sad, which is the last Amshinover, the most recent Amshinover Rebbe, if you Google him online, you will find that he died this past year in April in Borough Park, during the early part of the COVID pandemic, and he died of COVID-19. And his two sons are now the current Amshinover Rebbeim of Borough Park. So kind of a remarkable like life and a remarkable arc to this entire story. So it kind of connects to all aspects. Anyhow, he's got this really great teaching that I really, really like. So Rabbi Shimshon Shalom of Amshinov is going to be reflecting on a comment, we have to go all the way back, a comment of the Midrash on this text. So remember, the whole thing that I was talking about that's of interest to us is this word Ein ze ki im beit Elohim, right? This must be the house of God, says Jacob after he has the meeting with the angels. And so there's this midrash that goes like this. Avram called it mountain. Yitzhak called it a field, but Yaakov called it bait, house. A fascinating little comment. So the midrash is interested in how God and where God meets with our patriarch for the first time. So Abraham encounters God on the mountain, of course, Har Moriah, the story of Abraham and Isaac going up the mountain. Yitzhak is, we are told, meets God in the field, and that's based on a text we did 2 weeks ago where we know that Yitzhak is going out to the fields, and the Talmudic commentators ask the question, what's he doing out in the fields in the afternoon? Or before evening is the text. And the answer that our Talmudic commentators in Brachot give us is he was praying, which means Yitzchak met God in the field. And finally, Yaakov, he doesn't call his meeting place with God a field. He doesn't call his meeting place with God a mountain. He calls it a bite. So there's going to be a neat little Hasidic comment on this. Rabbi Shimshon Shalom of Amshinov said, Avraham began making the world known of the divine, which is Elokut, and it was the notion of the divine appeared to humans as a high mountain that only one person alone would be able to ascend to God. So in the Amshinova Rebbe's explanation, he's basically saying not only does Abraham meet God on the mountain, but God is the mountain, right? And what are the qualities of a mountain? It is high. It is solitary, and you go up by yourself, right? So for those of us who love the kind of Buddhist metaphor of, you know, going up into the mountains to commune with the guru, that's Avraham here. Avraham is has a solitary meeting with Hashem Yisborach. The text continues. Afterwards, Yitzhak continued, such that the divine appeared in the world as a field. So again, instead of it being God appeared to Yitzchak in a field, it's that God appeared to Yitzchak as a field. Fascinating, right? So the divine appeared in the world as a field, that everybody needs it for their sustenance. So he's the Amshinova Rebbe is growing the metaphor, right? Avraham goes up to a mountain, which is harsh and cold and lonely, and you meet God by yourself. Yitzchak meets God in a field, which may be more communal, but that's not the important metaphor here. The important metaphor is the field grows food, right? He goes out to the field. It's growing wheat. This is a place where you get your bread. So we finish it off, although we could spend hours just on this metaphor because it's so cool. Then came Yaakov, and the holiness and the divine were fashioned into a house and a residence, that humankind could dwell in it forever, in summer and in winter, and be rested and tranquil, joyful and in delight. So there's this notion here that God is changing God's evolving relationship with humankind through the patriarchs and matriarchs. God appears to Avraham in a very solitary way, in a one-on-one kind of meeting. With Yitzchak, in a way that's more providential and providing, right? That Yitzchak meets God in a way that Yitzchak comes to understand that the bounty that we experience as human beings, all our sustenance comes from Hashem Yisborach, from the Holy One, blessed be. And then finally, we get Yaakov, and Yaakov dwells with God in a house, a physical place, which is warm and comfortable and inviting. And it's very Hamish, you know, it's homey, right? It's warm and it's welcoming and it's communal, right? You have people over to your house when we're not having a pandemic. And it creates a sense of comfort and familiarity and protection, right? We're protected from the elements in this house. And it's really this lovely, amazing kind of metaphor that I think we could do two more things with as I conclude. One thing is to say that God's relationship with humankind evolves through time, that from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob and then on through Moses and then up to our time, the relationship and the understanding of the human-divine interaction changes and grows through time, which is the thing I think we often think about or don't think about when we look at the Parsha, right? That Abraham's relationship with God is different than Moses's. Moses is more complex and more evolved, and our relationship is more complex and evolved. But the other piece that's interesting here is the notion of maybe not it evolving, but our own relationships with the divine as being paradigms of one of these three iterations, right? Sometimes we meet God in a solitary place, in a one-on-one kind of moment, right? Maybe it's when you are hiking in nature literally by yourself. Or maybe it's when you're taking a yoga class and you just feel a little ting. Or maybe you're reading a book that nobody else you know has read and you can't share it with anybody and you feel a moment, right? That's your solitary moment with Hashem. And then there's this moment where we say, you know, Hamotzi lecha min ha'aretz, and we achieve a recognition of the divine God of sustenance. And in that moment, we are interacting with God as Yitzchak does in basadeh, in the field. By the way, he uses the word kesadeh, right? Like a field. So we are understanding that God is like the field that provides the sustenance. And finally, maybe we come to know God as the thing that provides us comfort in difficult times. Kebayit, God is like a house, a protecting element that makes us safe and makes us feel secure and confident and happy. So that's kind of like the metaphor that we've got for today. That's our class for today. If anyone wants to stick around and kind of ask questions or comments, please do. But otherwise, you know, I try to hypothetically stay within the rough 75-minute window that I've arbitrarily established for this class. But yeah, I hope you guys have a great Thanksgiving if you've got a knock off right now. And stay safe, stay at home, don't have too many people over, and, you know, don't overcook because, you know, for me, I don't think my kids will eat 98% of what I make anyways.